During the Chair's Report segment of the December 4th Citizen Review Committee meeting, CRC Chair Kristen Malone expressed some frustration about a recent meeting at the Mayor's office, which was attended by her, CRC Vice Chair Candace Avalos, and the Mayor's Public Safety Advisor, former President of the Portland Police Association, Robert King.
Every other month we've been meeting with the Mayor, and this was the first meeting, I think, in time that I've been Chair, which is a while now, that the Mayor himself hasn't been there. So it was just Robert King, which was unfortunate because the focus that Candace and I have discussed and that we wanted to shed on this meeting was frustrations I think both of us have been hearing and personally sharing from the CRC, at least some members of the CRC, about the amount of support we're getting from the city, not necessarily IPR, but the auditor's office, and at the end of our kind of big slog of standard of review work that it just kind of seemed to fizzle unceremoniously and without much fanfare. And this was something I think that all of us have been working pretty hard. We made the decision as a group to kind of suspend work on a lot of other important work groups in order to get this proposal finished on the repeated representations from many on council that they would be supportive of it. And we did our level best to, 2 years ago, preview the kinds of arguments we thought might be made in opposition to that proposal. And at least in our meetings with the mayor, he had said, I'm not worried about it.
Malone is referencing a few things there, namely the CRC's efforts to change its standard of review, which basically limits them to deciding whether or not the police bureau's decision in a misconduct case could have been made by a reasonable person given the evidence in the case file. The CRC cannot call new witnesses or examine new evidence. They are ruling strictly on the reasonableness of the findings. The CRC brought up concerns related to the Police Association labor contract, which touches on IPR investigations, as well as the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, which found several years ago that the Portland police regularly use excessive and deadly force against people thought to be having a mental health crisis. Malone says the mayor had previously told her not to worry about the potential objections of the police union, and that she could expect support from City Council for the standard of review change.
Obviously, that was the exact reasons that were attributed to the decision not to take it up at the end of the day.
Yeah. Malone went on to express further frustration with the city's lack of support for the all-volunteer committee.
The CRC is supposed to be an essential piece of our oversight framework, and it is our functioning is a part of the settlement agreement, and it is, I think, important for them to not volunteers with a feeling of hopelessness because we're not we don't have to be here.
Chair Malone said that Robert King did ask her and Avalos what support from the city would look like. Malone brought up that more support or attendance from Auditor Mary Hull Caballero's office would be nice. The two IPR leaders in attendance, Director Ross Caldwell and Deputy Director Dana Walton McCauley, were then grilled by Malone and CRC member Daniel Schwartz about how much attention the city actually pays to its only citizen-led police oversight body.
Is IPR regularly reporting to the auditor about what happens in these meetings? Is that something that is happening?
Yeah, we check in. This is the third CRC meeting I've been to. We've been one previous appeal. So yeah, we check in.
No, not you, but are you reporting to the auditor's office?
Yeah.
Obviously you guys are engaged, you're sitting here.
Yeah, we're reporting to Mary.
Is that on a monthly basis? Or are you, how might the auditor become informed about anything that is discussed at this meeting?
During our check-in meetings that we have with Mary.
Okay. And how often are those meetings?
I meet with her bi-monthly. I think Ross meets with her monthly. Okay. Weekly.
And then kind of as needed, whenever we need to.
Okay.
And I think, CRC would probably come up once a month after this meeting and just kind of fill in summary. But I guess, I have questions, but I don't know if that would be out of order at this point.
Well, if you guys are, or believe that you are functioning as that channel that you're asking for, it would be helpful, I think, to kind of flesh out what your questions are and maybe...
Yeah, I guess, What kinds of things would you hope for us to report other than the summary specific? Are there specific things that you're hoping that we communicated to the auditor that you don't feel have been communicated, or?
Yeah.
We can just start with the auditor's presence at the meeting.
Well,
like, does the auditor know that she would be welcome at a CRC meeting?
I think that she is aware that she could come to the meetings, but I think she also sees that as Ross's and my bailiwick, especially with us being new and trying to help us get established as the point people for this group.
She's gone in the past. I think she's certainly feeling she could go if she wants to.
It's my sense that she's kind of stepping aside to give us space to, I don't want to say own the group, but, you know, to kind of be the point people for, since we do.
Vice Chair Candace Avalos brought up the long, slow history of declining engagement from city government at CRC meetings.
I mean, I think it's one thing to have council here, because I think that was I think maybe one or two meetings. At the very beginning, we had like council, then it just stopped.
City council?
Yeah, city attorney.
And then it just stopped abruptly, and then there, it's like things like that happen, where it's like there's no communication as to why, really, or...
So like 3 or 4 years ago, myself and the co-chair would meet maybe every other month with the auditor to kind of check in on this is what the CRC is doing, this is how things are going, and these are our concerns, and this is where we could use some of your muscle and trying to, you know, help improve the process or something like that, and she stopped taking those meetings, and nothing replaced that communication, really. I mean, it just became silence, and then, you know, we're doing work and putting out reports and proposals, and we're getting the rejected stamp from her office, but there's no bilateral communication there. It's just this kind of, we don't know what she knows about what we're doing. I mean, I had some email communication with her recently for the first time in like 3 years, and the impression she gave me was that, you know, how was I supposed to know what's going on in your meetings? And that was a source of frustration for me, because I felt like she had kind of intentionally disengaged, and I would like her to know what's going on in these meetings, but I don't know how to make that happen.
Well, I would say, I guess, you know, I'm not going to speak to anything that happened before I was here. There's a little history there, obviously. We don't have any CRC-specific check-ins. We have check-ins about all the tons of other stuff that we do, and this is a relatively small part of that. But if there's anything that you want us to pass on to her, please let us know what it is. I think the more specific, the better, and we can get you answers.
I mean, in my personal opinion, I think I would rather go back to having a structure where we are meeting regularly and we have some direct channel, because, I don't know, I just feel like we should have that. So that's my opinion. I appreciate your work and
certainly something we can certainly ask, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, again, some of this predates me, but...
Well, I mean, and to your point, Dr. Caldwell, there is some history there. I still don't know what it is. I mean, we have still never communicated about why we stopped meeting.
CRC member Andrea Chiller detailed some specific ways the auditor could have helped the committee in the past.
I feel like there was a lot of frustration with the proposal for the modification of the standard of review, and I think we were hoping that the auditor's office would be an ally, and that did not come to pass, right? It felt like a door was shut rather than helping us advocate for that change. And
the shutting of the door was not very well messaged.
Or messaged at all.
And then also because I think there was some focus put on, at first it was, this is not something that would have to be part of bargaining. And then I think the idea was that, well, is something that would have to be subject to bargaining, and well, now we're at bargaining, where is it? Like the contract is in bargaining. Where is our proposal? How do we advocate for our proposal? Is there a way to make that a part of it? And there, I feel like it was just a no and not wait, or here's our plan and here's what we should do. It was just no and then silence.
Chair Kristen Malone noted that the committee had run over time a little bit and needed to get to the appeal, but she summed up the committee's frustrations one last time.
I mean, I think that my frustration at last meeting was probably visible because it felt like nobody who was answering questions on behalf of the city seemed to have the lens of how do we make meaningful change happen. It was more, what are all the ways that you can't do things? And it was frustrating for a committee that's really trying to find a path through to not really feel like anybody is trying to do that with us. Anyway, I encourage CRC members to think about that. I have definitely kind of heard some exasperation from people in this room and not in this room, and obviously I share that, but if there is a way for us to work together with the city to make it better, at least that's an ask that's being made of us. By the mayor's office, and it seems like by FPR now, so.
And by appellants in the past, and by community members who attended the meeting.
By a lot of people.
Okay.
So all of this stuff gets a little dense, so let's take a short musical break before we get to the appeal, which stems from a complaint against an officer who refused to take a woman's stolen vehicle report. It proved surprisingly contentious, and by the end of the evening, everybody only agreed on one thing. The DMV is terrible. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Totality of Circumstances. We're covering the December 4th meeting of the Citizen Review Committee. The police misconduct appeal that was heard by the CRC this month stemmed from the theft of a woman's car. She'll mostly be referred to as either the complainant or the appellant throughout the show. She bought a car from a friend, and within days, it was stolen. She went to make a stolen vehicle report, and the officer she spoke to at East Precinct, here called Officer A, refused to take the report because the vehicle was not registered to the appellant. Well, that was because of a mistake on the part of the DMV. Because they failed to record the mileage of the vehicle properly, the car was still in pending status. Officer A told her to go get the paperwork taken care of and then make the report again. That was impossible because the information needed was either on the speedometer or in the glove box of the stolen car. The car itself turned up in Salem, where an impound lot sent a lien letter to the car's last registered owner, who was the person who sold it to the appellant, and that person passed along the car's location to the appellant. It wound up costing the appellant $1,800 to get the car released. When they made their complaint in May of this year to IPR, the appellant made two allegations. One, that Officer A would not take the vehicle report, and two, that Officer A did not adequately document the missing vehicle. The second allegation stems from Officer A's statement that he would put the car on a so-called missing list. As we will find out later, there is no such thing. The appellant was represented at the CRC hearing by an appeal process advisor, or APA. These are volunteers, often former CRC members, who guide the appellant through the complex appeal process. This time around, the APA was T.J. Browning, one of the first members of the CRC after it was formed in 2001, and a longtime critic of the city's police oversight system. Browning gave one of the more thorough and lawyerly presentations that I have ever seen at a CRC meeting, complete with copies of all the relevant documents and others obtained from Oregon DMV.
So, the complainant filed under DMV directive, application for title and registration, the seller application for replacement title, because she couldn't find the title. the registration to the car, as was the case with many of us, was in the glove box of the car that was taken. So when the officer said she produced a handwritten bill of sale, that was not accurate. And this is more than just a handwritten. This is actually, because I went to DMV, the way the forms are, this is the receipt that you get from DMV when you fill out the form for title. So the car is taken, she reports the car theft in August. So the first thing that's vexing is all the material that we all had to go through that have nothing to do with this. Nothing. It doesn't matter if she didn't pay the right amount. It doesn't matter if she didn't sign, although there is no place on here to sign. None of that matters. What matters is they went down to the DMV, got this. When she called the police to make report, she handed the officer this. The officer at the time did not know the paperwork was messed up. She didn't know the paperwork was messed up. Whether it be DMV, her fault, the seller's fault, whoever, nobody knew that at the time that she attempted to make the report. So all this stuff in this file doesn't really have anything to do with the complaint she's making. All you need to know, they followed the directions of the DMV. She produced it. Unlike the officer's statement, it is not a handwritten bill of sale. She couldn't have. DMV had the handwritten bill of sale.
That was a presentation given on behalf of the appellant by Appeal Process Advisor T.J. Browning. Here's CRC member Andrea Chiller.
At any point did the officer say anything about contacting a sergeant or anyone above the officer's level about any report?
You asked him.
I asked him, and he said, they're going to say the same thing. And I said to him, I said, well, I'm not sure what else I could give you except for what the yellow paper is, which is where you go to pay. Get it put in your name and you wait for a title. That's the paper. Anybody who, prior to the new paperwork, anybody who goes to license register the car gets this yellow paper. That's all you get. So, but still, I mean, I paid to have the car put in my name. That's what this is. If I would have just had all the paperwork, then maybe, I'm not really sure what anybody else other than myself could give them but this yellow paper, because this is all they give you at the DMV.
Did the officer ever talk about contacting the seller of the vehicle?
No, and I explained to him that the tags were expired, that I was afraid if it got impounded, then I what do I do? And he said, so the lien, I had a lien put on me. The tow yard said the person I bought it from was in their name. And I said, then how do you put a lien on me? He said, well, we can see that she released interest to you through the DMV records. So that's how they put the lien on me. So that means I had financial interest. So, I mean, it sounds like that means I'm the owner, but for some reason the DMV didn't give us the right paperwork and it was pending. So if the tow yard can see the lien as me being it being released to me, how come the officer couldn't? And when I asked him about the tags and if it got towed, then he said, I'll put it on a missing list, and then you'll be notified. But I wasn't.
The Bureau, whose Internal Affairs Division, or IA, conducted the investigation into this complaint, was represented by East Precinct Commander Tasha Hager, who explained her reasoning in exonerating Officer A on both allegations.
So it is not unheard of for people to try to report cars stolen that don't belong to them. In domestic situations, in civil situations, in disgruntled neighbor situations. So it's not unheard of. And the impact of how we deal with stolen cars when we find them, it's impactful to the community members that are found in those cars. So we want to be very sure that when we're dealing with the occupants of a vehicle that has been reported stolen, that it is a legitimate stolen car. Oftentimes on those stops, they become high-risk stops. There's multiple officers that are involved in that. Officers will pull their weapons. People who are in that car find themselves in handcuffs in the back of police cars. And if it's just a mistake, or we shouldn't have taken that report, if we end up being in a position where we should not have taken that stolen car report, then the citizen who ended up in the back of our car in handcuffs, who's now traumatized by that experience, will come back and ask us, why did you take that stolen car report when there wasn't proof that they owned the car? So we, our officers are very aware when they go to take a report that they have to have definitive proof. And what I was given in this case file to me was a receipt of, I am applying to have it, but I don't have it yet. And I would say, after listening to the appellate's, I'm not sure, attorney, or to listening to that, I mean, my heart breaks because DMV is, to me, I look at this as a complete failure of DMV in how they did things. And I'm not sure, you know, or in their explanation of what the process is. Typically, you have to have a title before you can transfer title. So if you're applying to get a title, you actually can't transfer it yet. It does not sound like DMV probably did their job, but that doesn't really translate into Officer A not doing his. So as much as I feel for the appellate on how DMV handled this, the officer really did look at our policy and follow it.
That was East Precinct Commander Tasha Hager. The directive in question gives a short list of acceptable proof of ownership, but also has a catch-all clause allowing the officer to use some discretion in unusual circumstances, or when the person making the report can demonstrate that there is a process of transfer of title ongoing. CRC member Sylvan Frazier asked why this situation did not apply.
I have a follow-up on that, though. So just, you know, reading the words of the policy, I would very strongly assume that documents indicating the process of transfer of title would apply to, you know, that it would be a broad reading of the phrase process. I believe earlier you said, you know, you thought that was maybe outside the process because it wasn't actually done being transferred. That seems like a very limited scope of the term, you know, process of transfer of title. Is there any elaboration in writing anywhere in any policy or any sort of decision that says what qualifies as process of transfer of title, or is that just, honestly, it kind of seems like you guys are making it up.
If you look at what a notice of transaction submitted says, it says this notice is not an indication of temporary notice. It's a receipt that you've applied for something.
And that's not part of the process of the transfer of the title?
It probably is. But the problem is that it is not transferring title. So this is not proof of ownership. That's what this is saying, that it's a receipt. That was my view.
So part of the reason that we devote so much airtime to the Citizen Review Committee, besides the fact that their meetings are easy to get to, is that it is one of the few places to see people bickering out in the open over the minutiae of police policy. Not just what the policy is, but what it means and what sort of leeway cops have to interpret that policy. The bickering isn't just hot air either, it has weight, and it's also one of the few officially sanctioned ways for citizens to push back on those policies and interpretations when they damage a citizen's well-being. Over the past few years, but especially over the past two CRC meetings, the questions of effectiveness and access have been paramount. Are the people who really need this committee to hear them able to access it? And does that access produce just results? The answers to those questions have often felt like no to the people on the CRC, before the CRC, and observing the CRC, but the answers to those questions are also evolving month to month. This month, something happened that is rare but not unprecedented. The CRC moved to change the first allegation finding from exonerated to not sustained with debrief, meaning that there was insufficient evidence to prove or disprove the allegation, but there was reason to give the officer some guidance, quote unquote. Then CRC member Sylvan Frazier made a counterproposal to change the finding to sustained, meaning the officer did what he was accused of, and he was wrong to do it, and there would be discipline for it. The CRC voted, and Frazier's motion won 4-3. The allegation will go back to Chief Danielle Outlaw for review. If she agrees, that's that. And if she doesn't, there will be a conference hearing in a few months. If there is still no agreement, the matter goes before City Council for a final vote. A CRC appeal has made it to Council 3 times in the committee's 19-year history, and 2 of those times were in the past 2 years. The second allegation, which stated that Officer A had failed to put the appellant's car on a missing vehicle list, was unanimously affirmed as exonerated by the CRC. However, a few of them noted that the allegation was worded poorly. The officer was exonerated on the charge of failing to place the appellant's car on a missing vehicle list because, well, there is no such list. CRC member Daniel Schwartz had this to say.
Who wrote this allegation? Was it IA who wrote the actual allegation? If this is the actual allegation, it should have fallen under the untruthfulness directive. We should be deciding whether the officer lied to the appellant. I vote to affirm. Yes.
So all in all, it was one of the more dynamic Citizen Review Committee meetings that I've been to. And we have about a minute to spare. This has been a very dense and focused episode, so let's cut loose, lean back, and shoot some fish in a barrel, shall we?
To me, I look at this as a complete failure of DMV in how they did things.
The entire system failed you, and I think the officer has probably failed you. By this awful form, which is essentially just a receipt. This entire situation is an oversight from someone who makes a form. For that to cost you so much is pretty stupid.
I don't know how helpful it is to you for us all to say how aggravated we are on your behalf. But it's real. A DMV screw up, but a citizen who has done nothing wrong should not have to pay for this.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Totality of Circumstances. I'm Sam Bowman, and additional reporting was done by Jasmine Moneymaker. You can find full shows and longer interviews at our page on kboo.fm, and you can reach out with feedback or ideas to totalityradio@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland, your one and only. Good night.